intervening space, but matter could pop into existence from nothing at all. Provided, in the words of Alan Lightman of MIT, it disappears again with sufficient haste. Perhaps the most arresting of quantum improbabilities is the idea arising from Wolfgang Pauli's exclusion principle of 1925 that the subatomic particles in certain pairs, even when separated by the most considerable distances, can each instantly know what the other is doing. Particles have a quality known as spin, and according to quantum theory, the moment you determine the spin of one particle, its sister particle, no matter how distant away, will immediately begin spinning in the opposite direction at the same rate. It is as if, in the words of the science writer Lawrence Joseph, you had two identical pool balls, one in Ohio and the other in Fiji, and the instant you sent one spinning, the other would immediately spin in a contrary direction at precisely the same speed. Remarkably, the phenomenon was proved in 1997, when physicists at the University of Geneva sent photons 7 miles in opposite directions and demonstrated that interfering with one provoked an instantaneous response in the other. Things reached such a pitch that at one conference, Bohr remarked of a new theory that the question was not whether it was crazy, but whether it was crazy enough. To illustrate the non-intuitive nature of the quantum world, Schrödinger offered a famous thought experiment in which a hypothetical cat was placed in a box with one atom of a radioactive substance attached to a vial of hydrocyanic acid. If the particle degraded within an hour, it would trigger a mechanism that would break the vial and poison the cat. If not, the cat would live. But we could not know which was the case, so there was no choice, scientifically, but to regard the cat as 100% alive and 100% dead at the same time. This means, as Stephen Hawking has observed, with a touch of understandable excitement, that one cannot predict future events exactly if one cannot even measure the present state of the universe precisely. Because of its oddities, many physicists disliked quantum theory, or at least certain aspects of it, and none more so than Einstein. This was more than a little ironic, since it was he, in his Annus Mirabilis of 1905, who had so persuasively explained how photons of light could sometimes behave like particles, and sometimes like waves, the notion at the very heart of the new physics. "Quantum theory is very worthy of regard," he observed politely, but he really didn't like it. "God doesn't play dice," he said. Or at least that is how it is nearly always rendered. The actual quote was, "It seems hard to sneak a look at God's cards, but that he plays dice and uses telepathic methods is something that I cannot believe for a single moment." Einstein couldn't bear the notion that God could create a universe in which some things were forever unknowable. Moreover, the idea of action at a distance, that one particle could instantaneously influence another trillions of miles away, was a stark violation of the special theory of relativity. This expressly decreed that nothing could outrace the speed of light. And yet here were physicists insisting that somehow, at the subatomic level, information could. No one, incidentally, has ever explained how the particles achieve this feat. Scientists have dealt with this problem, according to the physicist Yakir Akhranov, by not thinking about it. Above all, there was the problem that quantum physics introduced a level of untidiness that hadn't previously existed. Suddenly, you needed two sets of laws to explain the behavior of the universe: quantum theory for the world of the very small, and relativity for the larger universe beyond. The gravity of relativity theory was brilliant at explaining why planets orbited suns or why galaxies tended to cluster, but turned out to have no influence at all at the particle level. To explain what kept atoms together, other forces were needed, and in the 1930s, two were discovered: the strong nuclear force and weak nuclear force. The strong force binds atoms together. It's what allows protons to bed down together in the nucleus. The weak force engages in more miscellaneous tasks, mostly to do with controlling the rates of certain sorts of radioactive decay. The weak nuclear force, despite its name, is 10 billion 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 times stronger than gravity, and a strong nuclear force is more powerful still, vastly so in fact, but their influence extends to only the tiniest distances. The grip of the strong force reaches out only to about 1/100,000th of the diameter of an atom. That's why the nuclei of atoms are so compacted and dense, and why elements with big, crowded nuclei tend to be so unstable. The strong force just can't hold on to all the protons. The upshot of all this is that physics ended up with two bodies of laws, one for the world of the very small, one for the universe at large, leading quite separate lives. Einstein disliked that, too. He devoted the rest of his life to searching for a way to tie up these loose ends by finding a grand unified theory, and always failed. From time to time he thought he had it, but it always unraveled on him in the end. As time passed, he became increasingly marginalized and even a little pitied. Almost without exception, wrote Snow, his colleagues thought, and still think, that he wasted the second half of his life. Elsewhere, however, real progress was being made. By the mid-1940s, scientists had reached a point where they understood the atom at an extremely profound level, as they all too effectively demonstrated in August 1945 by exploding a pair of atomic bombs over Japan. By this point, physicists could be excused for thinking that they had just about conquered the atom. In fact, everything in particle physics was about to get a whole lot more complicated. But before we take up that slightly exhausting story, we must bring another straw of our history up to date by considering an important and salutary tale of avarice, deceit, bad science, several needless deaths, and the final determination of the age of the Earth. 10. Getting the lead out. In the late 1940s, a graduate student at the University of Chicago named Claire Patterson, who was, first name notwithstanding, an Iowa farm boy by origin, was using a new method of lead isotope measurement to try to get a definitive age for the Earth at last. Unfortunately, all his samples came up contaminated, usually wildly so. Most contained something like 200 times the levels of lead that would normally be